Good morning. I'm Cal Winslow, your host, and this morning we begin a new series of programs. We're calling them Where Are We Now? And our purpose is to examine some of our most urgent concerns: climate change, gender, race, and inequality, the Earth's diminished resources, as well as humanity's, as we enter this new period of transition. What is the state of things? Where are we coming from? What is the balance sheet? What's at stake? Our guests every other Thursday morning here on KZYX will be Vijay Prashad of Trinity College, the author of Darker Nations, A People's History of the Third World; Judith Butler, UC Berkeley professor who's author of Gender Trouble; Michael Watts, also from UC Berkeley, who's the author of Black Gold; and Richard Walker, founder and past president of the California Studies Association. He's the author of Country in the City and The Price of Bread. This morning, we begin with Ian Bull. Ian will be well known to many of you. He's been a frequent visitor to Mendocino County, talking, listening, supporting causes here. He's a member of the board of the Mendocino Institute. He's a Guggenheim scholar and the author of Resisting the Virtual Life. He divides his time between London and Berkeley. Morning, Ian.
So Ian, a new term, at least seems like it's new to me, is being used more regularly these days. It's the term Anthropocene, if I'm saying that correctly. I wondered if you could explain to us what exactly that term means, where it's come from, and does it have significance for our subject this morning of climate change?
Yes, Cal, that's a good place to start. Anthropocene, etymologically, is a combination of two Greek words, anthropos, meaning human, essentially, and scene, C-E-N-E, which is the ancient Greek kainos, meaning recent. And listeners will have heard of the Pleistocene and the Holocene, perhaps. These are technical terms, and remember that, you know, science always, Western science typically goes back to Greek and Latin to make things sound often obscure, but there's a good side to it in that it's these ancient languages perform as a kind of lingua franca for objective common knowledge, although they carry a price. The Anthropocene is interesting because it's been used informally for some decades, but it's now passed into popular currency, especially since an important paper in Nature in the year 2000, written by a Dutch atmospheric chemist called Paul Crutzen, and he won the Nobel Prize for work, important work on ozone depletion and the chemistry of that. And in 2000, he proposed that the Holocene, which is used by geologists, by stratigraphers, those interested in the layering of the Earth's rocks as a way of trying to estimate and investigate the solid Earth and its history. He thought that the Holocene, which is the term which was widely accepted and acknowledged and to describe the interval of time since about 12,000 BP before the present. And that was chosen because it was not a sudden, but a large event in the Earth's history. It was the moment of the retreat from the peak of the last great ice age. And in 2000, Crutzen thought, well, I think the Holocene is now superseded by what he coined it, but he didn't know that it had been used informally by others before, as essentially the age of humans, if you want to, the epoch of humans, if you want to put it that way, if you translate it back into English. Well, why did he say that? Well, he, like many people, he understood, and he was, you know, he grew up in a world in which the effects of human industry, and in particular of warfare and the atomic bomb, had indeed affected the surface of the Earth and all who live in it, above all, very dramatically by global fallout from after the Trinity test in 1945 of July. And he suggested that Anthropocene was a good new term. It was a very controversial among geologists because it didn't seem that necessary, because geologists had long understood that humans had an impact on the Earth. But this was going to be very, very recent, and it wasn't clear that this would be accepted by geologists and the Committee of Stratigraphy that meets occasionally to decide on the classification of the Earth and its rocks and so on. What, of course, Crutzen was tapping into was a popular understanding that we may be heading into extremely serious climate change. And Crutzen never said that it was, I think, ultimately anything other than, in a way, a kind of a political move. I may be exaggerating there, but I don't think so. And in fact, in a recent essay, he said that I coined Anthropocene with humans to wake up. I mean, he's a scientist saying this. And there's a huge debate, of course, within science about how fast these effects and so on are. But, you know, essentially the American population has been sensitized, you know, since the Second World War, and particularly Rachel Carson, to dramatic, large effects produced by humans. Now, those who say that we're heading for catastrophe are really scientists who say that, are in a strange way coming back to a rather old and Christian view that, which was essentially that the Earth wasn't that old. Darwin, who required very deep time, to use a powerful poetic phrase, who required very deep time for his theory of natural selection and evolution to work, was faced with the fact that the best estimate was that the age of the Earth, that the Earth was rather recent, not as recent as his own family Bible told him, which was that humans came along after, you know, 5 days after creation, but that he believed, and it was the best estimate when he was young, that the Earth was perhaps, you know, 6,000 years old. It wasn't very old, and that the processes, however, that created the world as we perceive it, were, in a useful phrase, catastrophist. You know, we're talking about volcanoes and frogs and earthquakes and fires, and it was related to divine wrath and a sinful world and so on, and that the Earth was simply a stage on which the human drama was being played out. The Christian view was also, of course, that the Earth and all its inhabitants were put there, and that species were fixed, and that the end times wouldn't be far off. Now, what happened in the 19th century with Darwin's theories emerging out of work in paleontology and investigations into scientific investigations into rocks and atmosphere and so on, that this picture was wrong and that there was plenty of evidence that the Earth was very old. And right now it's been pushed back, you know, beyond 4 billion years, for example. So there's a very deep time for the Earth's history to unfold. What Crutzen and others who've started to use Anthropocene, and by the way, the word, of course, has now spread very quickly all over, you know, the social sciences and the humanities, and it's been picked up, of course, by journalists and somewhat in popular culture. The technical question is still to be decided, and I'll just finish the discussion of the word Anthropocene with this, to say that right now the Committee on Stratigraphy has decided that the impact of human activity on the Earth's surface is so great that yes, Anthropocene is a merited term, and that officially the world's scientists or the within geology that decide these things, that it probably will be adopted. But the problem that they face is they're not quite sure where to put this beginning of the Anthropocene. Where does it start? Because these other epochs actually are defined very pragmatically with spikes that rock hammers, you know, bang into some rock boundaries, you know, in different places on the Earth, and saying that's the reference point against which all discussion of within the Earth sciences about the history of rocks and the Earth. The problem for the Anthropocene is that nobody can easily say when it begins, and so there are various candidates. It looks like the Day of Trinity, July, mid-July 1945, is going to mark this moment if the Anthropocene is accepted, which it has been in principle.
Sorry, Ian. Trinity again?
Trinity was the name, the code name given to the testing of the gadget by J. Robert Oppenheimer and the Manhattan Project at Alamogordo in New Mexico. It was a sort of proof of concept, you know, and very soon, you know, days after that, the two bombs were exploded over Japan. So in a way, the Anthropocene, if that is accepted by the scientists, is a sort of scientific version of the name given by Lawrence, who was a journalist, at the end of the Second World War, when he coined the phrase the atomic age. Certain scientists say, well, look, of course, surely it's about 1800 with the cranking up of what's called the Industrial Revolution, where you get, you know, the so-called, you know, acceleration of industrial processes, the stripping out of the carbon stored in the coal measures, for example, in Britain and elsewhere, during the Industrial Revolution, so-called. Others say, well, hang on, deforestation back at the beginning of agriculture, you're talking about thousands of years ago, shouldn't that be the beginning of the Anthropocene? Well, whatever's decided ultimately by the committee, I think, you know, the listeners should just understand that these are scientific debates within something that's now agreed that that humans, that science is acknowledging, you know, massive human effects on the planetary climate. So that's where we are with the Anthropocene. I will just add one note, which might be interesting. That rereading, as I was preparing for this conversation with you, Cal, I read a recent piece by Crutzen, Paul Crutzen, the Nobel atmospheric chemist, and he's hoping for that there will be kind of a techno fix and that we'll have a more harmonious relationship to nature, to put it in general terms. But he doesn't really, I think, grapple with the question of, you know, who this we is. I mean, he's addressing a kind of general humanity, and I think in our conversation during this program, we're going to have to ask the question, you know, how are we in the Bay Area or in Mendocino to think about the problems that are clearly very large and planetary. Crutzen uses the phrase the domination by humans of biological and physical processes at the planetary level. Well, I don't know what you think, but I'm not convinced that even though we've had startling effects, say with the amount of radiation, you know, dropping from the atmosphere all around the globe with the nuclear testing and the problem of radionuclides, I'm not sure we can call that domination. And in fact, the dramatic effects that we'll come to discuss perhaps in a minute, say with sea rise or the changes to the oceans on our shore here on the Pacific that we can expect and are experiencing now. I'm not at all... It seems to me that these are actually produced by... certainly by human activity, but actually by changes to what are just trace elements in the atmosphere. So just a word of about atmospheric chemistry here. 99% of the atmosphere on which living things aerobically depend is oxygen and nitrogen. The so-called greenhouse gases, which we might want to get onto for a moment, the so-called greenhouse gases are basically trace, are there in ratios that are, would just be called, you know, traces. I'm thinking now of things from the refrigerators, you know, the fluorocarbons, methane, and above all, carbon dioxide. So we have Crutzen to thank for making, I think his time was ready, that, you know, probably geology would come up with something like this, but we have him to thank for concentrating our minds. But there's lots of issues within the scientific community that are unsettled about how bad things are, what the deep history of climate change is, and that's you know, we could get into that, but it's a very complex and interesting picture.
Thanks, Ian. Let me interrupt this very interesting program for just a minute and tell listeners that this is KZYX Mendocino County Community Radio. I'm your host, Cal Winslow, and I'm hosting this morning the first in a new series of programs, the topic of which is, where are we now? Can we have a balance sheet? And I'm referring in that to the obvious fact that we're in a period of what may be very deep and important change in our country and in the world. I'm talking with Ian Bull. Ian Bull is a historian of science and techniques. He spends some of his time in England and some in the Bay Area. He's well known to many listeners, I think, here in Mendocino County. He's been very much involved in helping us, advising us, and working with us on many of the issues that we're indirectly talking about right now. Ian, I want to, before we change altogether, I'd like two things to ask you about. First of all, would you tell the listeners how to track down Crutzen? Can you spell his name for us?
Yes, Crutzen. K-R-U-T-Z-E-N, Paul Crutzen. And if you do a search engine, you'll find you'll find him easily, and they'll be easily also find references to his most recent sort of general piece called something like, What is the Anthropocene, or something like that.
Good. And before we leave, I'm just listening to you wondering about, well, if not Anthropocene, then what? What have we been living in? Is there a reasonable alternative being proposed? And secondly, I think many people in the back of their minds perhaps have the idea that that perhaps the very existence of these big historical categories in the Earth's history, perhaps they imply change, that change is something that we live with, and we're living with it now. How would you come back to those two problems?
Yeah, well, that's a very, very good, question, Cal. It certainly raises. I mean, we're still feeling, in a way, the shock waves from the discovery of deep time, and the relation of human history to the Earth history, and working as I have done for years in the context of the Earth sciences as a historian, it's very striking how profound the problem is, and how shocking it has been recently to discover that human time scales and human history and its categories have now to be somehow integrated with the time scales of the new geology. And by the new geology, I simply mean modern geology, which acknowledges what I'm calling, what is being called, I think, nicely, deep time, millions of years. It was thought for a long time that I think by historians that since Darwin, who insisted that the really important that human history is being played out against a sort of a backdrop of nature which is really rather stable, and that nature, if you like, is the scene of human history. He had to overturn, as I say, the Christian view and earlier views that basically that the world was put there for humans and their uses, that it was a habitable abode, and that was because of a divine purpose. We're still, as I say, I think, trying to deal with the shock for those who accept a kind of secular account of the world, that we don't really, there's no particular direction or end point. We know that they will probably, that we're in the very long term headed for heat death, and that our local star will flare up and then go cold. but that's unimaginably far in the future. The problem with our current periodization is that the way human history is being told, for example, is that we most historians working operate within categories like modern. You know, if you say you're an early modern historian in the Anglo world, most people know that you're probably meaning you're concentrating on something about, you know, three or four hundred years ago, and that's your patch. Well, where does modernity begin? You know, when does industrialism begin? So, in a way, all these categories, I think, Cal, about you know, what are the implications of this for our understanding, are sort of up for grabs. And I think it's part of the turbulence that we're all feeling right now, that the story, the song that we have sung to ourselves as scientists or as critical historians may not be working too well, may not be capturing things. And just to go back to the climate effects, right? A new study, a recent study by America's foremost atmospheric scientist, James Hansen, H-A-N-S-E-N, who notoriously has chained himself to the White House fence a couple of times, I think, trying to get people to wake up, saying that if we keep using fossil fuels, this is well known, as we are doing, that the Earth's atmosphere is going to become so turbulent that we're heading for catastrophe. Now, he has published something last year, in the middle of last year, in the in Atmospheric Chemistry and Physics. This was I think in the middle of the year, on sea level rise and superstorms and ice melt. And he's been using, you know, very big data and computers to show that the general scientific consensus might have been too sanguine about the possibility of keeping things from running away. It's very easy to frighten ourselves, and I don't want to give the impression that it's all hopeless. We shouldn't, I think, fall into that. But it's worth knowing that there is consensus that Anthropocene makes sense, but not at all about how serious things are. Partly because it's a very complex system that we live in, and if it's difficult for a historian to figure out what the big explanatory forces are in human history, it's extremely difficult to understand the planetary system. Weather, especially, there are so many different variables and degrees of freedom, and some things are positive feedback, some things are negative feedbacks. It's extraordinarily difficult. So, for example, if we were to decide that we really have to, you know, if there was a general decision to cut back on fossil fuels suddenly by bringing the world's fleet of automobiles to a halt, the particulates that are thrown into the atmosphere would diminish. It would actually advance global warming, maybe catastrophically. So we're actually finding particulates in the atmosphere a useful negative feedback which are a form of unwitting combating of the planetary warming produced by combustion. So, in general, I would say I'm not even sure where we are, where with trying to find out the truth behind this. I don't think we'll know soon, and how we mesh human history and its categories with this kind of science is unclear. I just would speculate that we're sort of all catastrophists now. For the longest time, if you went to listen to a lecture at the campus here at Berkeley, until about the year 2000, I would say, when Crutzen notoriously, made this proposal, I think an undergraduate would have been taught that essentially the key to understanding the Earth and its history was to assume that most of the forces at work were sort of invisible and very, very slow, and that we were in for a kind of open and very long future. If deep time operates backwards billions of years, then deep time is an arrow pointing forwards in which the human project can go on indefinitely. That now seems to be I don't know whether how pessimistic you are, but one can understand that theories of history and human history are changing before our eyes under the impact of our understanding of climate history.
Well, I don't know if it's my place to come in on that discussion, Ian, but I can't let another point pass that I've been thinking about since you mentioned it. You've found, or not maybe not you, but you and others have found the origins of this current situation in what you call Trinity in 1945, and I think you referred to it as the atomic age. And yet, isn't it true that overwhelmingly what we hear about is fossil fuels, not radiation? And yet, I promised myself that I would not mention a certain party on this program, and here we go. But haven't we just heard about the prospect of more nuclear testing? And could, before we go on to all the other things that you've said that are so important, could you just take us back to this idea of the atomic age? Isn't that something that's kind of we've forgotten about?
Yeah, thank you for saying that, Carol. Absolutely. It's very striking how, I would say, for most of the 90s, for example, if you talked about the atomic age or nuclearism in many circles, it was regarded as somehow antiquarian, or are you still thinking about that? Isn't that over? Haven't we solved that? Rather in the way that big tobacco has persuaded the population that, lung cancer and smoking it's kind of been solved. Isn't that over? Don't we know that? Whereas in fact, maybe a billion people will die from lung cancer in the 21st century. So it does raise the question of how does our knowledge making and how does science relate to general the sort of the social atmosphere? I think it's very striking that I'm doing work on the discovery in the mid 50s that very low doses of ionizing radiation, which was a byproduct of Trinity and the nuclear weapons. It's not that the scientists like Oppenheimer and those in the Manhattan Project who built the bomb, they didn't. That was an unwanted byproduct. They wanted a very large explosion. The radiation from the explosion was unwanted, and the atomic age pressed on. Even though in the mid 50s we now know that it was discovered that very low doses of ionizing radiation are deleterious and even fatal for the growing fetus, particularly between 10 and 17 weeks after conception. It was discovered by an English physician and epidemiologist, Alice Stewart. She discovered that the cause of a spike in childhood leukemias. Was shocked to find that actually it was to do with, you know, single doses of fetal X-rays to the pregnant mother. It was said to be safe, that there was a threshold, and this is where, you know, faith in science has to be tempered, that it was going to be safe, and that was, she understood that as a scientist herself and a physician, that this came from the studies of those who had survived in Hiroshima. When she began to look at that, she discovered that the tainting of science, if you like, by power and by powerful forces that wanted not to acknowledge the effects of ionizing radiation, that these post-Hiroshima survivor studies were flawed, and that took her to an analysis of those who worked on the Hanford stretch at the plutonium factory up in Washington on the Columbia, and so on and so on. So in a way, we get the science we deserve. I mean, why the atomic age? Why nuclearism is not front and center? That itself is a very good question. I agree with you.
Okay, well, another question that I've been thinking about listening to you and thinking about this subject. What do we mean when we say science says, or the scientists say, or because that was this peculiar debate that was carried on over the last year or so about global warming and climate change. What is today in this area? What is science? How do we approach it? How do we understand it? Is it a single thing?
That's a very good question. The word scientist only comes into the English language in the middle of the 19th century, interestingly. Before that, the emergence of what one would call Western science, it's a long history, but it crystallizes in the 17th century, around the time of the English Revolution, and where capitalism and modernity emerge on the northwestern edge of Europe. And it's essentially among circles of men who are trying to figure out how to push back against religious accounts or you know, superstition and that kind of thing. And they develop what they think is a kind of royal road to knowledge. Mostly these were gentlemen who didn't have to work. And oddly, it's odd to think now, given the professionalization of science, there was suspicion at that time, right through until the domination of people who had professional training in these particular forms of knowledge. There was suspicion of those who were paid to do this kind of work, to accumulate the kind of knowledge of the Earth and its systems and so on, everything we'd now call modern science. We've reached the point now where something rather serious has happened, because just a couple of minutes ago I talked about big tobacco, and there's evidence. It's registered in the court system in this country that there was a conspiracy by the big tobacco companies. To fraudulently claim that they did not know what they did know, which that there was a link between lung cancer and smoking. I mean, and that conspiracy has a time and a place and a building in 1954. They had their own scientific laboratories, and there was a shocking internal memo, shocking to those of us who thought that, you know, scientific laboratories and people in white coats would be producing, if not reliable knowledge, but at least good faith attempts at understanding the phenomena that they were investigating. A notorious memo emerged in the late 70s from the tobacco laboratories, which said, an internal memo which was leaked, which said, doubt is our product. And in other words, there was a deliberate attempt by people trained in science and who were hired by these big private corporations to produce doubt, which historically, if you were trained in philosophy or social and cultural sciences at university, you were told that that was a good thing, going back to Descartes. Now, this has been turned around, and I think everybody and those of us following this stuff have used an interesting... there is what we call Gibson's Law. I won't say who Gibson was, but which is that for every PhD, there's an equal and opposite PhD. And so junk science, so-called, is muddying the waters. Very, very deliberate production of ignorance. And the playbook of big tobacco has, we know that it's often the same people. It's been traced out by a fine investigator and writer called Naomi Oreskes, O-R-E-S-K-E-S, Oreskes, in a book called Merchants of Doubt. She's tracked the shift, the translation from the big tobacco obfuscating the science of cancer science and so on, over to climate change and climate denial, which is important right now, of course, because the president-elect is on record as saying that climate change is a hoax and so on. So we've got to deal with the fact that it's very hard for the good people of Mendocino to know kind of who to believe. And, I mean, that is that there's no guarantee. There never is a guarantee in science. The problem is that science we have the best science that, in a way that money can buy, I'm afraid to say. And a lot of the work that goes on is because people can get paid for doing that, whether it's in medicine or geology or atmospheric science. So, yeah, I mean, it's hard to assess. There have been some definite advances with, you know, conflict of interest declarations, but it's not easy, Cal. Yeah.
This is KZYX, Mendocino County Community Radio. I'm your host this morning, Cal Winslow, and I'm talking with the scientist and historian of techniques, Ian Bull, who's talking to us from Berkeley, when we're talking about climate change. Ian, you've raised so many important things here that we really should follow up on, and we just won't have time to do it. But I know at the beginning you mentioned, you said you'd like to say a few words about the issue of sea rise. And just now you've used the term muddy water. Well, we have a whole lot of muddy water these days around here in Mendocino. You see the many thousands of gallons rushing down the Navarro River into the Pacific, chocolate brown. But Ian, as I said, we can't talk about everything, but I know you're concerned about this. How about giving us a kind of introduction to the issue of water and the sea and temperature?
Yes. Well, I touched on it a little bit earlier. This this new report by Hansen is very interesting. Historians of the Earth know that the sea level has gone up and down enormously, often because of mountain building and, you know, the kind of the tectonics question, but also because of the great pulses of the historically of the ice ages. And what we face now is as everybody knows, anthropogenic human caused ice melt. If James Hansen and his team, he's at the Columbia University Earth Institute, if he's right, then what's happening right now is that the great ice sheet in Antarctica is melting independent of the atmospheric conditions. And this will mean using his new model, that what we're going to end up with is positive, and that's to say amplifying feedbacks that increase the warming under the surface of the ocean, and more ice shelf melting at the poles. This will affect, he believes, and his team, the energy balance on the Earth and the heat flux. It's a very, very large planetary system, which is poorly understood. These feedback loops that he's talking about make ice sheets in contact with the ocean, both at the two poles, vulnerable to accelerating disintegration. And the worrying thing is that he says that that the loss of the ice mass from the most vulnerable ice, which is down in Antarctica especially, is enough to raise sea level several meters within, you know, a human lifetime now. This is much faster than even the general consensus was by the IPCC, which is the very large panel that considers these things within the scientific world. And they come up with the kind of lowest common denominator. And talking to glaciologists and others here at Berkeley, they've always been a bit more somber than these large committees. Now, if it is an exponential response, then we can expect multi-meter sea level rise in say, perhaps 50, 100 years. This is the work on paleoclimate is very important to compare what's happening for us, maybe with earlier moments and epochs in the Earth's history. Unfortunately, the new administration coming into power this month looks like they're going to be, you know, stripping out a lot of the funding for research into paleoclimate, and this is very worrying. This is very worrying, Cal, because of course one of the problems is that coastal civilization is, as we know it, is doomed in fairly short order if we don't prevent things getting out of control. And it may be that 2 degrees Celsius rise around the planet would be too much. Many of your listeners will know that Bill McKibben has had an organization, you know, the 350 parts per million for carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is a kind of a trigger point that we might be able to control things at that point. Hansen and Co. think that might be too large, looking at the history of the climate. This is why it's so important that there'd be pushback against the so-called agency capture and trying to prevent the shutting down of research into the question of climate. I mean, that's an extremely worrying development. And again, your listeners may have heard that some of the scientists working in various government agencies are trying to make sure that things are backed up and mirrored elsewhere because of the prospect before us when the when knowledge is desperately needed might be compromised by the appointment of, say, the boss of ExxonMobil, which is a company that certainly was complicit in producing junk science and was not exactly, they were not climate deniers, but what's interesting about big oil is that, in a way, it's evidence that they knew that there was, and they have no plan B. They knew, like big tobacco knew. They knew the reality of the likelihood of continuing use of fossil fuels, but wanted to suppress that information. It's quite scary to because all the recent international meetings under the auspices of the United Nations, going back to the fiasco in Copenhagen in 2009, when it looked as if perhaps Obama and Rodham Clinton would come and say something, you know, important and you know, serious about the climate problem, and essentially nothing happened. And following the recent meeting in November in Morocco, even the decision in Paris 2 years ago, where there was international agreement that 2 degrees temperature rise was the limit that people would accept. Nothing is binding, Cal. I mean, it's all, you know, I would say at the level of spectacle and the organization of appearances, I'm afraid to say. So what we're faced with is quite very serious changes, particularly for those of us who live on the littoral. So then the question is, if you're asking, you know, where are we now? We're now maybe at a crossroads. We for sure mustn't give up. And it seems to me that we need to produce knowledge ourselves as citizen scientists. We can't, for many of these important questions, there's nobody on the bridge, I'm afraid to say. And we have a system that's essentially predicated on the endless accumulation of commodities. And all that our masters can think of to say is that it's not that there are too many commodities in the world, but that there are not enough. In other words, the cap and trade system is all they can propose, which is to say, make a market of carbon, and then corporations will act in our best interest because they're acting in their own interest through cap and trade, which is essentially making a market of things like, you know, carbon and other elements which should not be marketized at all. So that's where we're at, I'm afraid, Cal.
Okay, and one last thank you, Ian, and one last question. I asked you at the very beginning, where are we now? So this isn't an easy one, but if you tried to propose a balance sheet saying that the first international conference was in, 95 or something, in the period of time that we've been talking about global warming and now, have we made any progress? Are things going backwards? Is there something to be optimistic about? What would you say?
Yeah, definitely there's something to be optimistic about, which is to say that the knowledge is out there. My pessimism comes because of the enormous structural problems of the system under which we live, which, as I say, is based on endless accumulation and exploitation and the pillaging and plundering of resources. So we have to, at the local level, we have to push back against the gutting of the regulatory state. It looks as if, for example, say the Saudi government and the incoming administration here want to go after what's left of the there's an enormous amount to go after those sequestered places from which they've been banned so far. I'm not saying they want to privatize all the national parks, but I think what we have to have is a clear understanding that it's up to us. It's only a social movement. And in fact, I am encouraged by the fact that there's very wide popular support, probably across other divisions in the country right now, very wide popular support for the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act. And those need to be defended. It's important. And that means local activity at the level of you know, the town and the county and so on, drawing on the best science that's available, given that a lot of the science that produced, unfortunately, it turns out to be irrelevant or a smokescreen or a distraction and so on, in order that, you know, there will be a world for our children and grandchildren. I'm very encouraged, maybe this is a place to finish, that given the disaster of Fukushima and, you know, these massive weather events that we can expect, superstorms and, you know, God knows, tsunamis and huge methane burps from the melting permafrost. But after Fukushima, Japan has made has a tremendous success in simply through conservation measures, because their nukes were shut down and they had to do it. So if the will is there, so if the popular will is there, you know, we can do things. We can make real differences rather quickly. I say this, of course, in the context, as I say, of the much deeper problem, in a way, of a system that is based on the pillaging of the world's commons, the soils of Africa. They're salivating at that right now, by people who are only agents of a system that they can't control anyway, the system we call capitalism, which is based on the commodification of the the earth and all its inhabitants and resources.
Ian, thank you very much. It's been very kind, generous of you to take all this time to talk with us about exceedingly important issues. I hope that we'll be able to have you back on the radio soon so that we can take up many of the topics we didn't have time to discuss this morning. But Ian Bull, thanks very much. Talk to you soon.
Thank you, Cal. It's been my pleasure.
This is Cal Winslow. I've been your host this morning. I've been talking with Ian Bull, the historian of science and techniques. Please join me in 2 weeks' time when I'll be talking with the historian Vijay Prashad, the author of The Darker Nations.